Thank you. It's very nice to be here. I was thinking that the title of this talk, The Darker Myths of Empire, is probably a misnomer. It really should be The Darker Truths of Empire, because... Thank you. It's very nice to be here. I was thinking that the title of this talk, The Darker Myths of Empire, is probably a misnomer. It really should be The Darker Truths of Empire, because... I am going to talk about some of the myths, too. and what there is really, there's an enormous disparity between what empires actually do and how they're represented in history. This is what I've found, that empires are pretty much written about by people who live in the imperial countries. And so the treatment of empires is rather celebratory. Empires are often represented as creations of peace. They're even given names of peace, right? Pax Romana, the Roman peace. The Roman peace was a brutal, bloody world conquest, as I'll mention in more detail in a minute. Pax Britannica, and there's even Pax Americana, which was, it's been the title of at least two books, one many years ago by Ronald Steele. Empires are often represented as bringing stability, justice, and prosperity to their subject peoples. They're represented as selfish things, large impersonal organizations that bring order where once there had been disorder. Just so you don't think I'm attacking straw men, who says that, who thinks that way, let me read to you from one great student of empire. He wrote a masterpiece of a multi-volume work. It's called The History of the Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, Edward Gibbon. Now, this is what Edward Gibbon says. The obedience of the Roman world was uniform, voluntary, and permanent. The vanquished nations blended into one great people. They resigned the hope, nay, even the wish, of resuming their independence. The vast Roman Empire was governed by absolute power under the guidance of virtue and wisdom. Yeah, right. That's the description he gives. I mean, not a word here about an empire built on shattered armies, sacked towns, burned crops, raped women, slaughtered herds, enslaved prisoners of war, oppressively overtaxed populations. Not a word about that. Empires are even sometimes represented as unintentional. That's when it really starts to get cute. This should have been called maybe the funnier myths of empire, this part of it. The product of unconscious circumstance. When I was a youth, in my salad days, I used to hear that the British Empire was put together in a fit of absent-mindedness. Did anybody else ever hear of that? It was an old saying. It used to be an old saying about the British Empire. I see only some of the old timers are nodding. I'm glad that phrase has gone out of style. Cyril Robinson, a British historian, he says the same thing about the Roman Empire. He says it about both of them, his empire and the Romans. He says, it was perhaps almost as true of Rome as of Great Britain that she acquired her world domination in a fit of absence of mind. How do you build an empire in a fit of absence of mind? How do you do that? You just kind of get up and say, let's go conquer Gaul today. Oh, did I say that? Or what are those armies doing up there? No. John Morley, English political leader and writer, talking about the British Empire, 1877. We have had imposed upon us by the unlucky prowess of our ancestors the task of ruling millions of alien dependents. We undertake it with a disinterestedness and execute it with a skill of administration to which history supplies no parallel. Yeah, again, I mean, let's deconstruct that a minute, would you? I mean, millions of alien dependents? Who made them dependents? They didn't ask to be made dependents on the British. They were brutally conquered by the British. They were independents until the British came along. You didn't inherit them. You went out and got this whole thing. And it wasn't undertaken with a disinterestedness. And it goes on like that. The U.S., too. Here, very recently, the year 2003, The Economist, a conservative British publication, no author. Empires are born in funny ways, and sometimes via the law of unintended consequences, by accident. And so with the American Empire. I mean, it's really interesting, isn't it? We hear that today also in a slightly different idiom. We hear that the United States, in terms of the United States, we hear the United States was, I mean, that's the first one where I found the absent-mindedness thing used again. But generally, there's another way of saying it. Say, the United States was thrusted onto the world stage. Or after World War II, we found ourselves having to take up the mantle of world leader. But we were just thrusted into this thing. They never say who did the thrusting. You know, some, what was it, the Canadians and the Mexicans kind of pushing us and say, come on, come on. Go rule the world, maybe. Leave us alone for a while or something. I don't know. In fact, ladies and gentlemen, I think a moment's reflection would tell you that empires are products of deliberate contrivance, of deliberate confection, planning, calculation, and manipulation. No social order can maintain itself in the long run. No social order can maintain itself without conscious human agency. In fact, that's why you have a state. The state is the conscious human agency of coercion to maintain a particular set of interests and order, which don't necessarily always look out for our interests, you know. Americans have been taught that empires and imperialism are something that other countries do. When I was in the sixth grade, my teacher said to us, the United States is the only advanced country that does not have colonies. We do not have colonies. And we'd look on this, we'd have this big map, and there would be these of the United States, and there'd be these box inserts all around the sides. It'd be Alaska, Hawaii, Puerto Rico, Guam, the Philippines. I'm really dating myself. These were not independent, and nor were they states yet. In fact, Puerto Rico is still owned by the U.S. So we'd say to her, Miss Myers, what are these blocks here? What are those? Aren't those our colonies? She said, the United States does not have colonies. It has territories. Or possessions. So, see, that's the magic of words. You wish away, or you define away, all sorts of brutal histories and realities by just using a different word. You got the administration today in Washington saying that the Geneva Convention does not apply to the people who are being held in captivity under very bad conditions at Guantanamo by the United States, because they're not prisoners of war. They're enemy combatants. But you know, enemy combatant incarcerated by your military, that's the definition of a prisoner of war. That's what a prisoner of war is. You get the enemy's combatant and you make prisoners out of them. So this use of, it's interesting how terms are now just being used to wish away things and situations. And this has happened with empire as with any of these other deceptions. The denial of empire in the U.S. was made easier by the rather early innovation of what's called neo-imperialism or neo-colonialism. Imperialism is the thing that empires do. So all those years when the communists were saying the U.S. is a capitalist, imperialist nation, and we used to say, oh, a lot of commie rhetoric, turns out it's true. We are. We go out and we control, not we, they, the people who run this country, go out and control other places. But much of that control with the American Empire in the very early stage was neo-colonial or neo-imperialist. And neo-imperialism was practiced, for instance, with Cuba. In 1905, after controlling Cuba for about 7 years, direct occupation with U.S. troops, the Americans turned around to the Cubans and said, look, we stole you fair and square from the Spaniards in a war which the Spaniards didn't even want to fight. They were willing to negotiate and leave Cuba and all that, but we really didn't want them to leave because then we'd have no excuse to invade you and invade the Philippines and take that from Spain and invade Puerto Rico, invade Guam, annex the Hawaii Islands, all these things that we did. So we stole you fair and square, but it doesn't look so good. We being a republic and a democracy, it doesn't look so good to have a colony. Miss Myers in sixth grade wouldn't approve of it. No, they didn't say that. But so they said, so we're going to give you your independence, and you're going to have your own flag. It's going to be red, white, and blue, but you get only one star because you're just a little island, you know. And you'll have your own money. You won't have to use U.S. dollars. You can use pesos or whatever you want. And you can put your own leaders on your money. You don't have to have George Washington. We're flex on this. You can have that. You have your Guardia Civile who will take care, make sure the people stay in line and crack heads. And if they can't do it that well, we have a little clause here in this treaty which says the U.S. Marines can come in any time to clean house on you. And so your own independence, you can continue to speak Spanish even. How's that? And the only thing we'll, or you do for us in exchange, is we will continue to control your and own your tobacco industry, your sugar industry, and control all your imports and exports and your nickel mines and your oil refineries and all your relationships with third nations, you know, other nations other than us. We will have a final say on all of that. So you're independent. Enjoy. Go out there and enjoy. So what you do is you give them the husk of independence, the shell of it, and you just take the substance of it. That's what neo-imperialism is like. Now, what's happened in recent years is it's become acceptable to refer to the United States as an empire. When I wrote Against Empire, which first came out 10 years ago, I mean, I had people come up and say, oh, come on, Parenti, aren't you going over the top? I mean, empire, what are you talking, U.S. as an empire? Now there's about 20 books out on the U.S. empire, isn't there? Sorrows of Empire, The Follies of Empire, The Crimes of Empire, Empire at the Crossroads, Empire in Crisis. I mean, just go out. Everybody's using the term. It's become a hot term. And it's good to know I was ahead of my pack here on this. And what's even more interesting is that the term empire has become acceptable to conservative commentators. You can turn on Fox and you could hear people say things like, well, we're the strongest nation in the world, and we're a superpower, and we have every right to act like a superpower, and we better act like a superpower. I mean, it's almost as if this power gives you entitlement. We're an empire, and we better get used to the idea that we're an empire, and this is the kind of thing. We're an empire with all the obligations and opportunities and responsibilities of empire. So what's left out again from all this history, all this commentary, is why empires? That was another thing I found was not... is this on, by the way? Yeah? I feel I'm There it is. Maybe I have to get a little closer. Why do people go out and conquer other places? It's usually assumed. I mean, you can read a whole history of the Mongol Empire, you know, or the, you know, and such. And Genghis Khan came here, and then they went here, and they destroyed these towns, and they went there, and they fought that battle, and they did, and all these details, and all through. But nobody ever asked, well, why? Why are they doing all this stuff? Is this just stuff happens again? You know, it's just in a fit of ferocious absent-mindedness, they're at it again? Or what is it? Actually, it's not conquest just for conquest's sake. It's not power just for power's sake. It's rarely power just for power's sake. Of course, individuals try to pursue and project their careers to get up there to get into positions of power and will sell their souls for anything. But generally, even they have to operate in a field of interest. There are interests involved. There are very real material interests at stake. There's plunder, and there's tribute, and there are resources and markets, and there's expropriating the land and the crops and the natural resources and the minerals and the wealth and the cheap labor, or in the case of Rome, the slave labor. Let me go back again and read you something else about the Roman Empire. It gets wearisome to read what all the British imperialist chroniclers say about the Roman imperialists and the Roman imperialists themselves, what they say. So let me give you a Roman imperialist, Sallust, writing at the time of Julius Caesar. This is what he says about Rome. Avarice was a thing almost unknown. Justice and righteousness were upheld not so much by law, but by natural instinct. They governed by conferring benefits on their subjects, not by intimidation. That's what he said about the Roman Empire. I mean, it's mind-boggling, you know? It's really rather mind-boggling. Is he talking about the Romans who went into Egypt and plundered and stripped that entire rich kingdom and tore up everything that ever there and turned it into a granary which they plundered? If you want to know why so many countries in the third world are so poor, just look at the history of imperialism. They weren't naturally and inevitably poor. They were made poor. Underdevelopment was something that was imposed on them. They were developing. They had wealth. Many of them had very advanced civilizations. They were forced back and plundered and impoverished. Going back to Rome, King Mithridates, when the Romans came in to his small kingdom, he said, "The Romans have constantly had the same cause, a cause for making war upon all nations, peoples, and kings, the insatiable desire for empire and wealth." And wealth, there's another word, and wealth. He put those together, empires and wealth. Caledonian chief, Caledonia's area, part of what we now call Scotland, right? Calgacus, I don't know how it's pronounced. "You find in the Romans an arrogance which no reasonable submission can elude. Brigands of the world, they have exhausted the land by their indiscriminate plunder. They create a desolation and call it peace. Our goods and money are consumed by taxation. Our land is stripped of its harvest to fill their granaries." Now we're getting a little closer to things, aren't we? Now we can see what it is. Empires are enormously profitable, mostly for the ruling class. Empires are also enormously costly, mostly for the common populace. The people of Rome didn't do too well on the empires. They got a grain dole, and that was it. They often paid the price in blood. They were piled up in tenements and like, and that's the truth of every empire. The empire feeds off the resources of the republic. And that was true of the Roman Empire in its days, right to the late republic. That was true of the British Empire, and that's true today. The people pay the taxes, and do without essentials so that the patricians can pursue their far-off plunder. The center is bled so that the perimeter can expand. Athens is defunded and starved so that Sparta can batten and grow ever more powerful. We see that happening today right here in this country. $200 billion being spent in Iraq. We don't know where one-third the money is going. The Pentagon has admitted at least one-third of the money is totally unaccountable. They just don't know. We're talking about billions of dollars here. We don't know where that money's going. There, I'm finally picking up the microphone. My throat was straining there. A few giant oil cartels are wreaking it in. They now have control of an oil resource. They don't have direct ownership. They prefer to keep it in nominal ownership to the Iraqi government. But they have control now of an oil reserve, which at today's prices must be over $5 trillion. $5 trillion. You could say, well, that's an oil supply that's for us consumers. We'd be without oil to heat our homes and fuel our cars. No, you wouldn't be without oil. When the Iraqis owned their own oil, they were happy to sell it to the U.S. at market prices. In fact, that's what the first Gulf War was about. Saddam Hussein wanted in. He wanted a bigger piece of the world oil quota. And George Bush Sr. was keeping him out and saying, no, Iraqi crude is some of the best in the world. It's the second largest reserve in the world. Oil prices were very low. He would glut the market. Prices would go down. You know what happens when prices go down on oil? Their profits go down. You know what happens when prices go up? Their profits go up, as you can see just recently. Record profits by the oil companies. We pay for that. We pay in the taxes. We paid that $200 billion. We pay, every community in this country pays that. I go all over this country speaking, and I pick up the papers, and it often looks like this. I'm in the same place every time, the same story every time. City council votes cuts in the budget. State legislature facing large deficit. This and that. Schools closing, libraries closing, hospital closing, lack of funding, so forth, so on. The empire feeds off the republic. Somebody's got to pay for that. They got more money than they can even count or hold accountable there in Iraq. Very little of it has gone to the Iraqi people. The water purification plants still haven't been put into function yet. After 3 years, very few of them. The electrical systems in many places, neighborhoods in Baghdad where you get 4 hours of electricity if you're lucky, so forth. Where is all the money going, everyone's asking? Well, for some people, empire is quite profitable. Don't ever say that George Bush's policy in Iraq isn't working. It's working. It's just not working for you or for me or for the Iraqis, but it's working for certain interests. It's working in the way that empires have always worked. To say George Bush's policy isn't working is a senseless comment. It's not a political comment. It's not a politically defined comment. So discard it, because you have to say working for whom? Whose interest? Cui bono is the Latin phrase. Who benefits? Who gets the payoff on this? And just because many of our liberal commentators don't know what they're doing doesn't mean they don't know what they're doing. You get it? And when you think those who rule you, when you think those who rule the wealth and control the markets and the labor and the resources of society and set the wages and define the labor market and control the media culture, and all that, when you think they're stupid, then you're being stupid. You got that? Okay. If you learn that tonight and you don't know anything else, you know more than if you know everything else, but you don't know that. So you got to really know that. Now, empires never stand naked in their rapacity. They never stand naked in their violent injustice. They don't turn to their people who have to pay the price of empire in taxation and the blood of our brothers and sisters and sons and daughters and fathers and mothers. They don't have to pay for that, but they got to tell these people something. And so they give their people a host of rationales. And this bring us to the darker myths now. I just gave you some of the darker truths. Here are some of the myths that, as you know, are always put about in this country and elsewhere. We're told that they're fighting for the security and the survival of our nation. We're told that they're fighting for democracy, for bringing it to others, for humanitarian rescues, to oppose dictators, to get rid of a man like Saddam Hussein. You see, right there, let's pause on that one a minute. How many of you have heard that? That part of this was to fight to get rid of Saddam Hussein? All of you have heard that, I know. How many of you have heard that it was the United States that put Saddam Hussein in power? Oh, this is a politically literate audience. Well, let me tell you, there are millions of people out there who don't hear it, and it's not their fault, because you can't hear it. You did not hear it on ABC, NBC, CBS, and what's that other one? I can't remember. So in 1968, the Iraqis had a democratic popular revolution. They overthrew the autocracy. They kicked out the British and American oil companies. They nationalized their oil. They nationalized their economy. They were developing a viable, communitarian, different kind of society. The CIA picked out very early Saddam Hussein. His first gig was an assassination. When Saddam finally came to power as head of the Ba'athist Party, he went out there and he exterminated either exterminated or drove them into exile or drove them underground. He exterminated every constitutionalist, every Democrat, every communist, every progressive, every reformist in Iraq. And when he was doing that, and he was torturing people and doing horrible things, when they say this about him, they're telling the truth. What they leave out is that it was the CIA that put him in there. They leave out that little detail. They don't tell the people that. When he was doing that, when he was at his worst back in the 70s and early 80s, he was Washington's poster boy. They couldn't get enough of him. Saddam Hussein, he's pro-West. He's our ally. He's pro-American. They gave him aid. They gave him bacteriological stuff to use against the Iranians. They sigged him on the Iranians because they didn't like Iran's nationalizing their oil and all that. It's when Saddam Hussein started committing economic nationalism, when he got out of line on the oil prices and the oil quotas, when he made it clear he wasn't going to privatize his economy, when he started developing his country and committing economic nationalism, as opposed to what you should do in a neo-colonial empire. In a neo-colonial empire, if you are a faithful servant of that empire, you are a comprador leader. That is, you lead your people, but you respond to what Washington wants. You say, come on in, boys, it's all yours. Take it, the natural resources, the oil, whatever you want. Our people get out of line, we'll crack them down. You just give me the aid, give me the guns, give me all that, and I'll take care of them, and you take care of me, take care of my brother Jose, my cousin this and that, or whatever, if it's Latin America, or if it's Africa, or Middle East, wherever it might be. And there's no environmental protection laws here. There's no minimum wage to worry about. There's no child labor laws to worry about. There's no occupational safety laws. You don't have any of that trouble cutting in. This is capitalism working at its best. This is the way the free market is meant to work. None of those regulations, none of those kind of things. You don't have to pay your workers paid vacations. You don't have to pay them pensions. You don't have to worry about medical care or any of that stuff. This is straight free market, all on your terms. You can pay them 18 cents an hour, and you'll get richer and richer. It's all yours. Those are the kind of leaders who are called pro-West, staunch allies of the U.S., pro-American. And the ones who challenge that, the ones who go against that, the ones who pose an alternative way of using the land, the labor, the natural resources, and the markets of the country, those are the ones who are called anti-American, anti-West. What does that mean, anti-West? Like Cesar Chavez or Gaddafi for a while and such, or Castro. It doesn't matter if they're communist or Christian socialist like the Sandinistas were in Nicaragua, or even right-wing militarists like Saddam Hussein in Iraq. So they tell us these things, that what this is why we're there, to save people, to introduce them to democracy, to help them, teach the poor little itty-bitty, apparently not very bright Iraqis self-governance, teach them how they can govern themselves. But here's a 5,000-year civilization. We're going to go in and teach them some things. This is the civilization that brought us writing, the alphabet, a lot of the early science and such. Very bright, resourceful people. But they haven't learned what we are going to be able to do now, teach them. Again, leaving out what? Leaving out the fact about the 1968 revolution and the country they were building on their own if they had been left and given an opportunity to build that country. The imperialists, the empire builders also, this doesn't have any projection. You got to stand like this with a, you can't get it a little higher, huh? Never mind, blank look when it comes. I know you can hear me because I'm straining. I'm talking without the mic. I would like to be able to get the mic. And this is the only, either you get the saturation stuff or you get me shouting to you without any amplification. It's amazing, you know. You can my unfulfilled ambition is to go to a college where they've got the sound system down. I don't know, but it's just, I mean, how long has amplified sound been with us now? About 100 years? When are they going to get it so that it would be effortless or something? It's working. You should feel what my throat is feeling now. Okay. Another thing the imperialists do is play upon our patriotic pride. One thing that's often bandied about is the idea that the United States is a unique country. It has a unique history. You want to know something? That's absolutely true. It's a very unique, remarkable country, a unique history. No other country has a history. The United States has. But you know, that's true of almost every country. They all have unique, fascinating histories. China, Egypt, Ireland, France, Great Britain. I mean, so many of them. They all have all sorts of interesting histories. Italy, Nigeria, South Africa, all sorts of things.